contract for a fundamental change in the way the train system is run. Labour vowing to reverse 30 years of private ownership. Within 5 years, the Labour politician who wants to run our transport network says privately operated train companies will be a thing of the past.
Labour will sweep away the broken model and bring private operators into public ownership as their contracts expire. We will establish Great British Railways, a single directing mind to control our railways in the passenger interest.
Welcome to Calling All Stations, the transport podcast. I'm Christian Womer, an author and journalist who has covered transport for the past 30 years. In every episode, we try to keep you up to date with the most engaging news stories, policy developments and interviews in the transport world. And with me is my regular co-presenter, Mark Walker, who has spent decades looking at transport policies and legislation. So, Mark, what are we covering today?
Hello, Christian, and hello to our listeners. And we're speaking to you today from a bolt hole in central London between the many interviews Christian has been giving on the publication of the Labour Party's proposals for the railways in Great Britain that they would seek to implement should they win the next general election. And we're going to spend most of the episode, I think, Christian, discussing these proposals and bringing our listeners up to date with the contents of Labour's documents.
Absolutely, which there's a lot of aspects to see. I see it's called Getting Britain Moving, which, of course, is even that's somewhat contentious, because do we want to people to move more? Would we want them to move less, which is more sustainable? But, you know, maybe that's been arcane.
I think you're going very, very deep green there.
Right, Christian, yes, absolutely.
Uncharacteristic for you as far as railways are concerned. But certainly I think it's a reflection of the tone of the document, which is one of suggesting that the railways in Great Britain are underperforming and in need of some urgent therapy, I think it would be fair to say.
No, absolutely. So what's the core message they're trying to get across in this, Mark? You've managed to I've read some of it, but I've been in doing so many interviews I've struggled to read the whole document.
And of course you're out there at the same time promoting your new book, which we should mention and which we'll also be returning to cover in depth in a future episode.
Absolutely. The Liberation Line.
The Liberation Line. Absolutely. Read it. Buy it. It's great. But turning to Getting Britain Moving, the Labour Party policy document, there are a number of really quite significant features about this, and we are going to try to talk listeners through some of those main points and some of the headlines. Are very interesting ideas in some cases that appear within the document. So perhaps the most significant thing about this policy paper is the linkage between Labour's proposals for rail and the five missions that have been identified by Sir Keir Starmer as being the integral objectives of a future Labour government, possibly as early as sometime this year, when it comes to the entirety of the Labour government's plan. So there are five missions, which are Get Britain Building Again, Switch on Great British Energy, Get the NHS Back on Its Feet, Take Back Our Streets, and Break Down Barriers to Opportunity. But the interesting feature is how this rail policy document has been aligned with each of those.
Yeah, no, and absolutely. And I think an important point to make here is that transport policy has so often been completely neglected. And here we have a transport policy being promoted very strongly right at the early stages of an election campaign, and linking it in with a whole lot of other aspects of policy, which is something that we've always accused governments of failing to do, which is to link transport with other aspects of policy.
So I think that's right. And to give an illustration, mission four is called Take Back Our Streets. And you might think, well, what's that got to do with railway policy, right, then? But the linkage is that it describes this as ensuring our roads and railways buses and transport interchanges are safe will help make our streets safe. So it's seeing the public transport domain as part of the sort of public realm, and thereby linked with crime and policing policies in a way that perhaps we don't typically see.
Right. Okay. So where does it start?
So then we go into the areas that are more specific to rail itself. And there have been identified 6 points in a vision for rail. And to summarise those, the 6 points are, first of all, reliability, which I think everybody would accept is a very important feature for any public transport.
And has been system. Failing lately, of course.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah. And even I think the vox pops on some of the radio and TV programmes that you've been appearing on in the last 48 hours have kind of suggested
that's
the public experience. Secondly, the simplification of the rail system, and in particular the simplification of ticketing. There are, as we know, thousands if not millions of different kinds of ticket available with all sorts of restrictions, and there seems to be a drive within this paper to see some simplification of the actual ticketing product, which is of course for what most passengers actually buy when they use the rail system. Thirdly, there is a theme of integration, and this is the concept of, interestingly, that Labour has bought the idea that the railways need a single guiding mind, which has been a feature of the Conservative government's attempts at reform.
Which
over the
triggered
last
off
6
by
years.
The May 2018 timetable chaos, which then led to the Grant Shapps with Keith Williams report and ultimately the rail reform bill that is not going to be a bill, not going to be an act because they haven't got the parliamentary time.
Well, which we hope to pick up again later
right.
in this episode,
yeah.
because there have been some developments there
right.
in the past couple of days. But interestingly, the theme of integration covers the what has been the principal headline in most media outlets since the publication of Labour's policy, which is the return to public ownership at the end of their current contracts of the franchised passenger rail services. So the idea that by the end of the first term of a Labour government, those contracts will have ended, the services will have reverted to public ownership and control, and then be operated within this new guiding mind that Labour aspires to have.
And yeah, interesting enough, that's been picked up in the media very much as they're going to renationalise the railways and it's going to take 5 years. Now, I think that slightly misses a point because a lot of the franchises, or a lot of the contracts rather, are less than 5 years and they'll be taken over before that. But also, Mark, you might disagree about this, but I suspect that as we get towards the end of this process and there's, you know, most of the contracts have been taken back in-house and there's 3 or 4 kind of out there, won't the private companies just think, oh, you know, we can't be bothered with this anymore and we'll just kind of sign them over and be done with it?
I think that's a very interesting prediction for the future of the way that these events might unfold. Equally, there could be companies that are very committed to their brand and their service offering and who want to stay in the sector for as long as possible. And it does raise the interesting point about, even in advance of that process of reversion to the public sector taking place, that the Labour government will inherit contracts being operated by private companies. So what kind of relationship do they want to have with those private companies? How might they seek to modify the existing contracts to deliver some of the passenger benefits that they hope to see?
Right.
I think that's probably something that the document is a tad silent on
right.
at the moment.
It's silent on quite a lot of detailed aspects.
Yes, indeed. Now, the next theme is one of improved quality. And this picks up an issue dear to our hearts because it does actually mention specifically improvements to passenger Wi-Fi. And perhaps it might be that we can track some of the origin of that policy back to our exposure 11 months ago now.
The scoop we had.
The scoop, this was a the scoop. Of the present government's somewhat misguided attempt to threaten even to disconnect or switch off passenger Wi-Fi on the GB
to save money network. And we haven't really heard about that since, and I suspect they gave up that rather bad idea.
I think that's the reaction may well have pushed them in that direction.
But I think this makes an important point, which is there is a wider one here, which is that to make the railways attractive, they have to have features like Wi-Fi, which I've always argued basically is essential, having toilets on trains, really. It's absolutely one way of getting people to use railways is that if you have Wi-Fi there and it's just part of the offer that the railways should be making to the public. So I think that's a very good point they've picked up on there.
Absolutely. And if the railways want to attract people back, particularly people who want to work on the train, who have been used to working at home, then they're looking to have the same kind of level of connectivity that they get in their homes or indeed in their offices when they
actually
reach
go further than that, and I don't know if this will be feasible, but actually ultimately you also want people who want to watch films on trains.
Absolutely. Yeah,
you know, yeah. and that really the Wi-Fi should be up to that if with the proper technology, and that will encourage people to travel just as much as having it for work.
The fifth point of the vision section deals with accessibility. So this is, I know, a theme that comes up rightly and constantly through elected representatives of all parties, that we ought to be able by now in the 21st century to make our 19th century rail network accessible to all kinds of people, regardless of any disabilities that they might have. And you would expect a future government to be pointing in that direction. And then the sixth is, and we've already touched on this slightly, it's a theme of safety, but perhaps not safety as we've traditionally considered it in the rail industry. Many of our listeners will remember following privatisation, arguably or otherwise linked to the phenomenon of privatisation itself, there were a series of major rail accidents and around about the turn of the century.
Yes, I link that very strongly in my book, On the Wrong Line. I link those accidents with the changes that arose from privatisation. And I think that is backed up by the fact that, you know, after those upheavals, changes were made and we've had, very few accidents since then. Only two.
Absolutely.
And both in which only a total of, I think, four people have been killed. So it has changed completely. It's interesting that it's no longer seen as relevant. Safety means something else.
Safety means something else here, because it's interesting and it's worth just spending a moment on this. Safe services. We will improve rail safety through seamless, reliable timetabling, better integration with other modes of transport to reduce waiting times between connections. So less hanging about in vulnerable places for passengers. And working with the police on staffing where there could be safety issues. We also seek to accelerate, target and better standardise the deployment of technologies across the network to enhance safety, promoting reporting of crimes and ensure evidence is recorded. So a very different emphasis on the safety front from what we've seen in the past.
I think quite aimed at women, that. And that we have a female shadow transport secretary, I think, has influenced that, and all power to her elbow.
Yeah, and linked with that Safer Streets mission. Now we then go from those visionary ideas to something that's set out as an urgent action plan with an emphasis on day one improvements. Now, throughout the document, Christian, there's a suggestion that there will be the need for some legislation, some kind of railways bill or perhaps part of a transport bill that will be introduced in the first King's Speech of a Labour government and enacted within roughly a year. But it's clear that the authors of this paper want to move faster than that when it comes to changes. So they're looking, for example, at modifications to the way that the industry is led, more collaborative relationships between the various parts of the industry, operators, infrastructure, and the people in the supply chain, and the Department for Transport, of course, which is going to continue to have a significant role during that intervening period. And there's an emphasis as well on the need to sort out the industrial relations issues, which I know you've been picking up in your interviews.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's point one is probably the first thing they can do to improve things from day one is to sort out the industrial relations issues. And I don't think it'll be that difficult. All they have to do is do something that we've discussed at length and I've mentioned several times in my rail column, which is to decouple the idea of pay rises with major changes to the way that people work in the industry. And the government, the Tory government, has refused to discuss that with ASLEF, the train drivers union, since January last year. They have not had a meeting, I mean, which is completely shocking, actually, because I think the Tory government has seen it as advantageous for political reasons to see these disputes. And that's really shocking. The whole thing is. So that can be solved right from the beginning. Just negotiate a deal with the unions. I'm sure they'll be ready to do that. And we'll get industrial relations dispute out of the way and immediately see an improvement. And not just an improvement in wages, Mark, but also an improvement in staff morale, I think. I think that's an important aspect of this, that, you know, people in the rail industry, both at managerial level and on the shop floor level, are really feeling that the railways are problematic. They've suffered from all these terrible industrial relations issues and other performance issues. And so this could really make a step change.
And of course, in a very real sense, the frontline staff in the operating railway are the salespeople for that
right.
for that product.
Yeah.
You want people that are committed and motivated and enthusiastic. There's also, we then go, Christian, from the urgent action plan into the change plan. And here are some really, really interesting points. So Labour has accepted the principle of an organisation, and indeed the name and the brand of an organisation, to be called Great British Railways, which of course was the title of the present government's rail reform
invented
white paper.
By Boris Johnson, it must be said, but yes.
And in a way, you know, perhaps that's to be expected because they're already promoting in a different sector the idea of Great British Energy, which
right.
will be their state-run energy corporation, as the name implies. But they've accepted that name and the branding. However, it's not clear at all that they've necessarily accepted Great British Railways as conceived by the current government,
which is with Network Rail at the top of the tree and essentially running the industry, whereas other people are suggesting that Network Rail should be at the service of the operators and not kind of master of them.
Yeah, and it's interesting that they've gone back to perhaps what was a theme of the original Williams report, which became the Williams-Shapps plan for rail, that Great British Railways would be a new organisation which would absorb Network Rail and its infrastructure role, rather than a brand which would be taken over by Network Rail, which is exactly where we are at present with
right.
the governments, the Conservative governments.
And you think that the Labour plan has not bought that idea? It's not expressing Network Rail as being at the top of the tree.
I think they haven't bought it, but I think the jury might still be out
right.
on whether they might be persuaded to accept it at some point, depending on how long it takes for the general election to happen and how far the Conservatives have got with their reform
right.
programme.
Right.
But it seems that they are not... In some ways, it's in a document like this, it's what isn't said is as important
right.
as what is. But what they do have is the very significant concept that was first launched by Shadow Transport Secretary Louise Hague in her speech at the Labour Party conference last year, which is the concept of the passenger in chief,
right?
Who
yes.
will be the Secretary of State for Transport. And that does imply to me a significant continuing role for the people that work for the passenger in chief, who are the civil servants in
right.
the Department for Transport. And you know, throughout this whole reform process, I don't know about you, Christian, but I've got a bit exasperated with the idea that somehow civil servants in the Department for Transport are a block on progress and a block on development, and in some ways are not interested in or committed to the railways, because from my experience many of them absolutely are.
Right.
And if there's anything holding back rail policy, it's the Treasury restricting those civil servants in the DfT.
Yes, I think not enough distinction has been made between those two, have they? People lump those civil servants all together when, as you and I know from our, you know, from our knowledge of the rail industry, the Treasury has stopped a lot of initiatives, and basically every time a train operator wants to spend money on what sounds like a perfectly good investment that will probably bring in more money than it costs, the Treasury kind of sits on it and says, oh,
that's
no,
right.
we're not having that. And that's what needs to be stopped. But I do think that ultimately, the idea of having a separate organisation is a good one, as a British Rail Mark II, but one that has relatively independence from ministers, a budget, and an ability to make decisions.
Now, moving on, there are some other interesting points in the document when it comes to the change plan. So there is a proper recognition of the role of the devolved administrations, Scotland and Wales, and increasingly the city regions of England
right.
in the development of rail policy. There's an interesting proposal to change the way that consumer representation is organised. The document points out that there are currently three organisations which have a role in consumer protection for rail. It wants to bundle them all up into one.
Those are passenger focus.
Transport focus.
Or transport focus is it now? The Office of Road and Rail and the Rail Ombudsman.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. But interestingly, because transport focus is now a cross-modal organisation,
yeah.
they seem to want to take the rail bit of transport focus out and then put it into a single organisation with the consumer protection role.
That means we are odd, because Transport Focus's origin was as the central consultative committee, which
for
was
rail,
actually
for
yeah,
rail,
for rail
that's
yes,
right. yeah,
which
yeah.
was a rail watchdog, and then yeah. it kind of expanded under Anthony Smith.
Yeah.
So who has now left, and so presumably is not there to defend the organisation.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting initiative.
And then they've deal with some rolling stock financing and manufacturing issues. They appear to have accepted that they will have their rolling stock investment program funded through the rolling stock leasing companies, rather than, as we've seen attempted in recent years with projects like Intercity Express and Thameslink, the state doing that financing for itself.
Right.
And as you might expect, there are some commitments on train building, given the
state of Derby at the moment.
Controversies
yes.
around Derby, Newton Aycliffe, and so on. There's a very strong commitment on rail freight, and I think, you know, it's probably hats off to the lobbying efforts of the rail freight sector to get that level of recognition in this document. So that it's not just a passenger proposal package, it probably recognises the vital contribution and growing contribution of freight. But then perhaps a little surprisingly, on the ideological front, and given what's happening with the train operating companies coming back into the public sector, it's very positive on the role of open access operators.
Now, I've always been rather sceptical of that, because you either have a railway that is regulated with the best timetable, which you know, is determined by a single organisation, or you have some sort of free market aspects. And my view is that if you have gaps in the network where you need kind of trains to go that haven't gone before, like Hull or Shrewsbury or wherever, from London, direct from London, then you can introduce those if that is kind of what the railway can bear. And so I think the idea that you get these private companies coming up with kind of strange ideas and pushing for non-existent train paths, I think is a mistake. But I think we somewhat disagree on that. I think you rather like the open access.
I'm not so much that I have a liking. I understand why they're popular with the stakeholders and the elected representatives of the places that
like
they
Hull,
serve,
yes.
Which are often marginalised communities, yes, that the mainstream rail industry has ignored.
Right.
And then the open access people come along and give them direct services to London, which brings economic benefits. So I can well understand the attraction of that. But it's an interesting contrast in this document. And then I think the final point I wanted to make, and we talked about the importance of the rail industry as a people business. There is actually the beginnings of some kind of workforce plan as well, recognising the impact of demographics, the retirements, the age profile of people in the rail industry, and indeed not just in the operation and infrastructure of railways, but across the supply chain and addressing those points. So I think there's some encouraging remarks.
Yes, I agree with that. I think the most important aspect of this is, you know, that it's a plan and that we haven't had plans before, and the whole chaotic situation of the railways, you know, has not been solved by the Tories, who, you know, said they'd have a plan 5 years ago or 6 years ago now, and they've never enacted it. And I think there's a wider point here, Mark, that I think is important. That and it was noticeable that the newspapers picked up Labour to renationalise and so on. And largely the coverage is very favourable. And that's because people, I think the papers understand that most people are in favour of this, that actually they like the idea of renationalising the railways. And they also feel a wider antagonism towards some of the privatised companies, notably Water. And I somewhat suspect that the water companies will be viewing this with some trepidation, and maybe some of the other privatised companies, seeing that, you know, Labour is prepared to do this. Now, even though I think these proposals are quite relatively weak and don't go quite far enough, but nevertheless, they might kind of, they raise the issue, both for the public might be encouraged by this, and I think the companies might be kind of slightly concerned that their turn is next.
And it's interesting that it is a bit of old-time religion, isn't it? Certainly in the way that it's being presented and the way that it's being reported as well. So, and there seems to be a buy-in right across the Labour Party senior team for this. It isn't just window dressing.
And
they
also
seem to really mean it.
Yes, and also it is Labour showing that they've still got some radical ideas, which I think people have been crying out for. So the fact that this paper has come out now at the beginning of the election campaign, as it were, I think is very, very important, and shows that you know, Keir Starmer is keen to show that Labour has some teeth. So, Mark, I understand you've been hearing news of the Transport Select Committee and its deliberations over the Rail Reform Bill.
Well, I think perhaps to inject a bit of balance into this episode, Christian, we should just take a look at where the Conservative government is with its own rail reform programme. Now, loyal listeners will know that the government published its draft Rail Reform Bill, so not a bill actually going through the process of being approved by Parliament, but a draft bill being scrutinised by the House of Commons Transport Committee, looking at it line by line, detail by detail, with the aim of improving it for the point at which it is introduced as a formal piece of legislation. Now, as part of that exercise, the House of Commons Transport Committee, under the chairmanship of Conservative MP Ian Stewart, launched a call for evidence. And last week we saw the publication of the evidence they'd received from interested parties. There were actually 71 pieces of evidence, which is remarkable, and takes a lot of reading.
Were these all organisations or some?
There were some private individuals,
private people, right?
But the vast majority were organisations with some either involvement in the business of running and operating the railways, public bodies, local authority organisations, city regions, supply chain organisations, trade associations. They're pretty comprehensively represented there. So there were 71 pieces of evidence published. The committee has then rattled on with the process of beginning to interview some of those people who submitted their evidence. So on the 24th of April, the Wednesday, the committee held its first two-hour evidence session, interviewing mostly representatives of trade association type bodies. Some of the themes that are starting to emerge are quite interesting, because of course this bill allows for the creation of something called an integrated rail body, of which we know there will only be one. It will be Great British Railways, but the status of integrated rail body will then be imposed upon, or bestowed upon perhaps, onto Network Rail, which will become the owner of that status, and which will then become the core of the Great British Railways organisation. There's lots of argument about whether it's just going to be Network Rail, in same old Network Rail, or whether it will be a Network Rail that changes in some way. So those sort of issues are starting to appear through the pre-legislative scrutiny process. But there's also lots of issues around the licence that the integrated rail body will receive from the Secretary of State to carry out its responsibilities. And essentially, I think one of the most interesting areas of discussion is just how arm's length will this arm's length body actually be? And to what extent will there be a residual command and control over the integrated rail body from the Department for Transport and effectively from the Secretary of State.
Do you think any of this will be useful to the Labour government, which we expect to be in power sometime later this year?
Well, I think it's probably helpful that these arguments are being rehearsed in this way. I mean, simply with the best will in the world, even if this draft rail reform bill were to receive a fair wind from the House of Commons Transport Committee and be introduced as an actual piece of legislation this year, it seems extremely improbable that it could be legislated for before a general election closes out the opportunity. But I think perhaps the Transport Select Committee, should there be a Labour government, will have produced a useful, gone through a useful exercise in exposing some of these issues. We wait to see from further evidence sessions just how this will develop. And of course the last evidence session I would expect would be with the Minister or the Secretary of State, who will answer
some of these
all of the questions that have been generated during the process. So I expect we'll keep an eye on this in future episodes of the podcast. Here's Christian's final thought from the Departure Lounge.
This is about a couple of innovations I've heard about on the railway. And one of these is the fact that LUMO, which is the open access operator on the East Coast, is dispensing with all plastic bottles and replacing these with cartons, which are supposedly, and I'm sure they are, environmentally more sound, and the tops are made from sugar cane offcuts and whatever. And basically, I think this is quite fun because, you know, the railways are presented as being environmentally sustainable, and Sometimes this gets forgotten in the things around the railway. You only have to see the piles of rubbish that come off train, intercity trains, when we travel on them. And the other innovation is one that I doubt will ever make it onto our shores, but apparently German railways are introducing kind of little compartments with smoked, screened glass, screened off from the rest of the passengers for private use. And I'll leave it to our listeners' imagination as to what that private use might be. I've got no idea. But I somewhat suspect we're never going to see that in Britain.
That's really good. Calling All Stations, the transport podcast with Christian Woolmar, is produced by Cogitamus Limited, a leading provider of public affairs consultancy services in the sector. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we especially hope the noises off weren't too distracting from our central London bolt hole in which we recorded it. If you have enjoyed this episode, please do consider giving us a 5-star rating with whichever platform you use. Do follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle is @AllStationsPod.